This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. For 4 years, climate change was not a priority for the U.S. under the Trump administration, but that seems to have just changed. Hours after taking office last Wednesday, President Joe Biden signed several executive orders to address climate change. In one day, the U.S. rejoined the Paris Accord, and the Keystone XL pipeline, a project to move oil from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, was canceled. It's clear that climate change will be a focal point of Biden's administration, but how much needs to be done to reverse years of inaction? Joining us now to talk about this is Senator Tina Smith. She's a Democratic senator from Minnesota. She's also a member of the Senate Democrats Special Committee on Climate Crisis. Senator Smith, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Jen. It's great to be with you again.
So as I said, addressing climate change was not a priority for the last 4 years of the Trump administration. We know time is essential in dealing with this crisis. What should be the next priorities, not just in undoing Trump's climate policies, but creating new ones?
You know, I think what we have to do is to completely shift the way we talk about climate action. For so long, we've talked about it as something that's going to cost a ton of money, that's going to require sacrifice, and how scary it is. And it is scary, don't get me wrong. It is scary stuff. But what we need to do is to understand that the United States can lead on climate action. And when we do that, when we lead on moving our country to net zero carbon emissions by the middle of this century, that is going to be good for our health. It's going to be good for our economy. It's going to be good for the fairness of our economy and help to address some of the systemic inequities that have been resulted from the last 100 years. And to me, that is the opportunity that we need to grab onto here. And I'm so excited about what we're going to be able to do, I hope, in the big infrastructure package that President Biden is already talking about, that many of us in the Senate are very eager to get to work on.
Well, speaking of the Senate, Democrats hold the Senate by a small margin, which means every Democrat would need to vote in the same direction in order to pass anything. How do you plan to get Democrats like West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin on board with climate policies they've historically rejected?
Well, I think there's two things to think about here. The first is that too often when we've talked about climate, we have ignored those individuals who have kept the lights on and kept us warm through in West Virginia, for example. I think of these folks as energy veterans. They're the ones that have done the hard work. And as we move to a non-carbonized energy future, we can't just treat those people like they are old hat. We have to put them front and center in our plans for how we move forward. So I think that's the first thing. But the second thing is that we need to be looking at this in terms of incentives and positiveness. I am the lead Democrat of a proposal for how to decarbonize the electricity sector by the middle of this century with a clean energy standard, which would say in essence that we're going to move our electricity sector to net zero carbon emissions no later than the middle of this century, and do it with a set of incentives. So states like West Virginia, for example, can choose the way that they get to that goal. And that will create opportunities in West Virginia and other states around the country that have often been sort of left out of the conversation.
Well, we got this tweet from Jennifer who says Biden should provide training as necessary for those currently working in fossil fuel industries so they can smoothly transition while remaining gainfully employed as our country embarks into this urgent change. This question of jobs and job training often comes up when we're talking about people transitioning to greener jobs. Is this part of your plan as well? And if so, what does it look like functionally?
It should be part of our plan, and we need to figure out how to make that happen. Here in Minnesota, we have a lot of people who work in, work building pipelines. And for us to simply say to those folks, oh, that job is over now, go figure out something else to do, is completely irresponsible. And it's disrespectful to the contributions that they've made. You also have to understand that a lot of these folks are probably nearing the end of their career. And so telling somebody that they need to get retrained in high tech, for example, is not really very reasonable. So we have to figure that out with the folks that are most directly impacted by by what's happening. But then there's another part of this too, which is we know that there will be hundreds of thousands of jobs, probably millions of jobs that are created in the clean energy sector, building transmission lines, building wind turbines. And often those jobs are not good paying union jobs. And so we need to figure out how to make sure that those new jobs that we're creating are the kinds of jobs that you can do to support your family.
We're talking to Senator Tina Smith. She's a Democratic senator from Minnesota. She's also a member of the Senate Democrats Special Committee on the Climate Crisis. Senator, we got this message from Marion in Michigan.
Rather than framing the issue as climate change science supporters versus deniers, the discussion should broaden its appeal by emphasizing the strategic necessity of renewable energy in terms of national security due to the expanding threat of cyber warfare on our critical infrastructure, especially our electric grid. In my conservative neck of the woods in northern Michigan, more Republicans than Democrats have converted to off-the-grid solar power because they want to be self-sufficient and they recognize the looming threat of cyber war.
Senator, President Biden is planning to sign an executive order this week that describes climate change as a national security priority. What do you think of Marion's point here that focusing more on climate change as a national security issue could get some of your Republican colleagues on board?
Well, I think Mary makes an excellent point, and it gets to the core issue that that I think we all should be talking about, which is that this addressing climate is a path for us to build on our innovation and build on our, you know, in business lingo, you would call it your strategic advantage, your competitive advantage. And if we seize that moment, we're going to be creating more opportunity and more security.
Well, on the Democrat Special Committee on the Climate Crisis website, it says, quote, "We cannot wait for Republicans in the Senate to accept, let alone propose solutions to fix climate change in a real way. Barring finding a bipartisan path to climate change policy, how much can Democrats get done alone in the long run?"
Well, first, I don't give up on the idea that we can find bipartisan support for addressing climate if we address it in the ways that we've been talking about this morning. I'll point out that the clean energy standard legislation, which I am the lead on in the Senate and which is a core part of President Biden and Vice President Harris's plan, that was originally bipartisan legislation back in the mid-2000 and first decade of the 2000s when it was led by Senator Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico. So there is a history of bipartisan support for things like the clean energy standard. But I also think that we have to understand that action is so needed. We cannot spend another 3 or 4 years kind of talking about this. It requires definite and determined action right now. And I hope that we can get bipartisan support. But if we can't, I think Democrats need to know how to take no for an answer, and we have to be willing to move forward. Here's how that might look. I hope we can get bipartisan support for a big, broad infrastructure package that has clean energy at its core. But if we can't, there are other tools, like, for example, the reconciliation process in the Senate that we can follow. That's how the Republicans passed their big tax bill that I wouldn't have supported.
Well, there's a chance Democrats won't hold the Senate or House in 2 years. So that's not a lot of time to get things done. What are your top priorities, and how can you make sure the next Congress or administration won't undo what you put into place?
Well, that's why we need to pass laws. And though I will say I'm grateful for President Biden with his executive orders, for example, to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, we need to be able to pass laws and we need to move with real urgency. So my priority is to pass a large infrastructure package that includes a clean energy solution at its core, because I believe that that is going to be the economic is going to be of such great economic benefit for the United States. And it also is going to create an economy that is more fair, because we have to understand and remember that the negative impacts of a carbon economy has disproportionately affected people, Black and brown people, who often live closest to the pollution that has caused such negative health effects.
We've rejoined the Paris Accord, as you said, but in the last 4 years, the U.S. has lost its position as a world leader when it comes to climate change. How can the U.S. regain its status as a global leader?
Well, I believe that actions speak louder than words, and that people will be looking to see the actions that we take, not only by rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, but also by the legislative action that we take here at home. The action that we take to treat with respect those that have kept our houses warm and our buildings and our cars driving for the last 50 or 60 or 100 years, and action to really move with determination into the future. And one thing that gives me great hope is the strong group of people that President Biden and Vice President Harris have put on this project. I'll just note Jennifer Granholm, who will be Secretary of Energy, I hope, was the former governor of Michigan, and showed how you can lead on climate in a state where there are lots of complexities on that topic.
That's Senator Tina Smith. She's a Democratic senator from Minnesota. She's also a member of the Senate Democrat Special Committee on the Climate Crisis. Senator Smith, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll continue our conversation about what a new Biden administration means for the fight against climate change, and you can chime in. Joanna emails, the only way to address our unsustainable use of this planet's dwindling resources is to dramatically change our lives quickly. Either we do it now or physics is going to force us into it. Rebecca emails, I think we need a revolution to fight climate change. Revolution means we need to change our consumption patterns in order to mitigate the effects of climate change. It needs to be a revolution like the Industrial Revolution or the American Revolution, and needs to happen over a period of time, but have a huge impact. You can share your thoughts, tweet us at 1A. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Steamy, steamy breaths and shine, flowers, grass, and trees all dead.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing what a new Biden administration means for the fight against climate change. Let's bring two new voices into the conversation. Amy Harder is an energy and climate reporter for Axios. Amy, welcome back.
Hello, great to be here.
Also with us is Christopher Clack. He's the founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy. That's a company that builds software and consults clients on clean energy solutions. Christopher, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Love to be here.
We also want to hear from you. How would you like to see the Biden administration address climate change over the next 4 years? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Amy, you were listening along to our conversation with Senator Tina Smith. Did anything she say stand out to you?
Yeah, certainly. Well, it was great to hear the senator's perspective. I think one observation I had is that so much has changed in the energy and climate arena, even in the last 4 years while President Trump was in office, but really over the last 10 years. We've seen costs for wind and solar plummet. We've seen big oil and natural gas companies really begin to reckon with this transition, try to be competitive in it. And so all of those factors and more are really making it easier for Republicans and Democrats to find policies that they agree with. And I think, it may not be a carbon tax or the Green New Deal anytime soon, if ever. But I do think there is the possibility for more substantive policy in this area because there's more, the energy technologies are becoming cheaper. And that makes people like Senator Joe Manchin more open to these policies because, as many of us may remember, in 2010, he shot a bullet through the cap and trade bill, the big climate change bill at the time. And that was because he was, worried about the costs. The costs are still a concern, but they're not as much of a concern as it was 10 years ago. And I think that's a really important point to remember when we look at what Congress may do on this issue.
Well, we talked about Biden's executive orders to revoke the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline and to re-enter the Paris Accord. But talk about what all that means. What are the implications of these orders?
Well, we often describe this as sort of the starting gun of a very long journey. Biden telegrammed frequently that he was going to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. That actually officially takes place in about a month or a little bit less than a month now. And that's the easy part. The hard part will be coming up with some sort of commitment that the U.S. will pledge to do some sort of percent reduction of greenhouse gas emissions to adhere to the Paris Climate Agreement. Given the limitations in the U.S. Congress, even with Democrats in control of both houses, given that that limitation, I anticipate Biden will be looking under every nook and cranny in the executive branch and across the administration, and also leaning heavily on states. So you have that executive order, which is expected, but still very symbolically important. The other two that I've been looking closely was sort of one laying out all of the regulatory actions that this administration will take, much of which is reversing what the Trump administration did. And then lastly, the Keystone XL pipeline, which really has become, you know, a political football. It was first proposed 13 years ago, back when the oil industry was very different. And although this pipeline is still important to Canada, you know, where the oil would come, and important to the company that's proposing it, it's really a shell of its former self in terms of its impact, you know, in the oil market and otherwise. And so I'll be looking to see what the regulations are, the new regulations that the Biden administration looks to impose after they work to reverse what Trump has done.
Christopher, you're a small business owner, and your work will be directly impacted by the decisions of the new administration. What's your initial response to Biden's actions on climate change so far?
Well, so far, it's been remarkably positive. We've seen sort of a stamp marked of what's going to be the future. As Amy said, it's sort of the beginning piece, and we're here ready, like many other small businesses, to kind of work with the administration and others to fulfill what would likely be a very transformative agenda over the next few years.
Well, a lot of you had thoughts on how you'd like to see the Biden administration tackle climate change.
What I would like to see Biden do regarding climate change is to incentivize the American oil industries to transition to clean energy. I spent decades working in the oil industry at all the major oil companies. As much as I would love for them to change on their own, unfortunately, it takes money for them to change.
You ask what climate action Biden needs to take. I think he needs to strongly support the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act.
The action I really hope the Biden administration and Congress take on climate is to enact a bill that would put a significant price on carbon, gradually rising.
I believe that we should pool all our resources that we can. The R&D subsidies should go to renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, whatever it takes. Put our energy into this.
Clay, Isaac, Allen, and Randy, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. Amy, so a range of thought there. Do we know if Biden is planning on doing any of these things?
Yeah, I think those are some great thoughts that were just shared. A couple quick points on the first caller's comments about incentivizing the oil industry. I certainly agree that in this capitalistic society, you have to prod people with money more often than, you know, perhaps many people would like. One big shift that I've noticed over just the last couple of years is really the oil and gas industry and the broader business community becoming more supportive of actual regulations, for example, regulations of methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas and also the primary component of natural gas. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Petroleum Institute both recently said that they support those types of regulations. And so I think to the reader's point, I do see some shift, and I do anticipate the Biden administration to try to prod the oil industry in some of these ways, and the oil industry will be more receptive than they have been in the past. And then secondly, on some of the comments about a carbon tax or a carbon fee, you know, there has long been discussions about doing sort of a steadily rising carbon tax in Congress. You know, economists will become blue in the head urging why this makes all the sense in the world. And it certainly does make sense from an economic perspective to at least, you know, show and price in the environmental impact of oil, natural gas, and coal. I think the Biden administration certainly doesn't oppose a price on carbon. Janet Yellen, Biden's pick to be Treasury's secretary, supports a price on carbon. So there is certainly this potential support for that. I think right now in this moment of time, with the recession still raging and the pandemic still raging, I think it's still just too big of a political hurdle to tax what, you know, many people, what many opponents, including Republicans, and I do think Senator Joe Manchin has also expressed concern about a carbon tax. I just don't think it would be politically palpable right now. I do think in the long term, a carbon tax seems increasingly inevitable as the economic costs of climate change grow.
Well, another suggestion from Alex on Facebook says, I want the Biden administration to focus on green energy as much as possible, but I also want them to embrace nuclear energy. Nuclear energy can be dangerous, but it almost never is. Focusing on nuclear energy could be our bridge between fossil fuels and renewable energy. Christopher, your response to Alex's suggestion there.
Yeah, so I think we have to concentrate on the whole portfolio. I think nuclear is definitely an aspect of it. We need to be able to build out the manufacturing of nuclear along with the renewables. We've seen with modelling that as you go further out, those technologies, the firm renewable, the firm clean technologies seem to really pencil out. We also need to concentrate more on things that are more necessary and are invariant of everything else that we put on the grid. Things like transmission really need to be some of the focus. Investment needs to go into that quite heavily to be able to put more renewables on the grid, but also enable building nuclear and other assets further away from population centres. And that will help both make it easier to build those technologies, but also make them feel safer for the public.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A, and we're talking about what a Biden administration means for the fight against climate change. With us, Amy Harder. She's an energy and climate reporter for Axios. Also with us, Christopher Clack. He's the founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy, a company that builds software and consults clients on clean energy solutions. Christopher, tell us a little bit more about what you do in your business.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So what we do is we've built software that plans out the energy grid and the electricity grid using different technologies and different cost assumptions, which has lots of detailed weather information. So we can understand how the fuel of the renewables works in the grid, how it integrates with the existing technologies and also possible future technologies. And we use that software to really kind of look at different pathways out to the future to kind of understand how those different futures might impact the customers, but also might interact the grid and how the physics of the weather might interact with that grid and gives us some understanding of if we put more and more renewables on the grid, does that actually change how we need to think about energy supply, as particularly as we think about electrification, bringing in other sectors into the electricity grid to allow us to really decarbonize not just electricity, but the whole economy across every industry in the economy.
Well, and how should we be thinking about our energy grid right now as we see more extreme weather and there are concerns about the security of that grid?
Yeah, no, exactly. So this is why we do these sort of portfolio planning exercises, because we really want to look and see if we can test the grid. And so there's obviously new areas that are coming up. Cybersecurity, we need to think about the transmission grid as being a vulnerable point in that, and how do we move electrons around the economy. But then as we look at the climate change impacts of extreme weather, we have to think about then how do we harden ourselves against that extreme weather, and do we have the ability to build enough renewables and other technologies to bring down the carbon that we're emitting in the atmosphere in a speed that can actually mitigate these really extreme events that are going to get worse and worse as we move further forward?
Amy, Biden has recruited a team of people to deal exclusively with the climate crisis for his cabinet. Talk about some of his picks and what they'll be doing.
Yeah, he has really is assembling and continuing to assemble a lot of people across the government and in all the different agencies. So leading with the White House, he's created a climate team inside the White House led by people he's very familiar with and names that'll be familiar to people who've been following the space. Gina McCarthy, former EPA administrator under President Obama, Ali Zaidi, who also worked under President Obama and was more recently working for Governor Cuomo in New York. I think those two people have a lot of experience, and I think the fact that this office exists is a testament to the fact that they concede that their power in Congress and perhaps even with regulations will be somewhat limited. And it's important to note that although, you know, the EPA, which will be led by Michael Regan, he has a lot of, he's an environmental regulator from North Carolina. I think it'll be more difficult for the EPA to really go aggressively on these regulations, in part because even before President Trump, nominated a bunch of conservative judges, the Supreme Court blocked Obama's regulation for power plants in 2016. And so I think there's some acknowledgement that there will be limitations for what the regulatory branch can do. At the Energy Department, I anticipate will be playing a key role, as what the former or Senator Smith has said, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. I think she has a great relationship with the auto industry. And given the limitations at Congress, I anticipate one area of bipartisan support will be to increase a lot of innovation funding. And so a lot of that money will flow through DOE. And so the people he has there will also be critical.
Well, Biden also has the opportunity to employ other departments. I'm thinking about the Department of Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, and bringing them into the climate change conversation. What could this approach look like?
Certainly. So I think an agency like Housing and Urban Development, I think one key way that that agency will lead will be to respond to a warming earth, the impacts of a warming earth. And so, you know, a lot of our focus is on how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the other side of the coin is we've already baked in, you know, half a degree Celsius of warming, and that warming is going to have a huge impact. And HUD, Housing and Urban Development, I anticipate will really focus on the adapting to a warmer world side, which is something that I think will need to be aggressively stepped up, even in the face of an increased focus on reducing emissions. The Transportation Department, of course, will also be critical. I think the Secretary, if confirmed, Pete Buttigieg, he will be focused on how to rebuild public transit after the pandemic and in a sustainable way. I think he'll view this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to try to build back in a greener way, which is something we've seen all over the world. Other agencies that I'll be looking at, two independent agencies that nonetheless often take the big picture views of the president. That's the Securities and Exchange Commission, which could force companies to disclose more on climate change. And then secondly, the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission, which oversees electricity grids. And going back to that conversation that we just had about the transmission grids, I think FERC will be critical in that conversation as well.
Well, Christopher, for 4 years, there was almost no focus on expanding the use of clean energy at the federal level. What do you think Biden's top priority should be now in regards to reaching zero carbon emissions?
Yeah, I think the administration really needs to look at the whole economy as a whole. Every emission that we put into the atmosphere, whether it's from electricity or other sectors, goes into the atmosphere. And so he has this goal of 2035 zero emissions from the electricity grid. And so that's going to be a primary focus, of course, and we think that's a great idea. We've also got to think about how do we get other sectors to want to be part of the electricity grid? How do we get them to want to electrify, as we call it? And how do we enable that through lowering the cost in that electricity grid to make it more of an incentive? And then to do that, what I've talked about, transmission, there's also distributed energy resources, which will help equity and justice for consumer side. Obviously, a lot of investment into novel technologies, these technologies that we need, not just for producing electricity, but also from converting between different sources. And so things like hydrogen production, synthetic natural gas, ammonia, because agriculture is a big emitter. And if we can decarbonize fertilizer, that will actually reduce emissions hugely. And so he's got a lot of options out there to work on. But the thing is, we have to work on all of them really, really quickly, because we don't really have much time to lose because of the last 4 years. But what I will say is that the last 4 years, we've seen the markets pick up, we've seen states pick up the slack. And so now hopefully there's huge momentum already underway in those areas. And so now we can really use the federal government to enforce that and push harder.
We're discussing what the Biden administration means for the fight against climate change with Amy Harder. She's an energy and climate reporter for Axios. Also with us is Christopher Clack. He's the founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy. That's a company that builds software and consults clients on clean energy solutions. We're also hearing from you. Stephen tweets, "I didn't wait for the government to promote the technologies for reversing climate change through better policy and incentives. I drive a hybrid vehicle, use LED lights, and upgraded all my appliances appliances to high efficiency ones. And Rose emails, it's important to get away from coal, oil, and gas as energy sources and move now to renewable energy. But one industry I don't hear mentioned is the agricultural industry. Plowing up acres of land kills the necessary microorganisms the plants need. Well, we'll get into it after the break. This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation about what the new Biden administration means for the fight against climate change. With us, Amy Harder. She's an energy and climate reporter for Axios, and Christopher Clack. He's the founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy. That's a company that builds software and consults clients on clean energy solutions. We got this message from Robin on Facebook who says, I want Biden to support farmers who use land and water conservation methods, reduce tax breaks for large corporate farms and animal farm operations that do not attempt to use greener and more ethical methods. Amy, what do we know about how President Biden is including agriculture in his climate change policy?
Well, agriculture is a huge part of this equation, and it's really become a bigger concern over the last 4 years as President Trump has sort of completely dismissed the problem. You're seeing other players, states and cities and other organizations really step up to consider this. And of course, livestock, cows and other animals, you know, are responsible for methane emissions, which is, as I said earlier, a potent greenhouse gas. And so Biden's pick to be agriculture secretary is actually Tom Vilsack, who was Obama's agriculture secretary. And from what I understand, there's a lot of programs at the Agriculture Department that can be utilized in a climate change friendly way. So I anticipate, and I think you've already seen one of the first meetings that the transition team before the inauguration did was to meet with the farming community. And the American Farm Bureau has actually come up with a climate change plan. And so the agriculture industry also, similar to the oil and gas industry and the broader business community, are really having a reckoning with this and are acknowledging and realizing that they need to be at the table. And so this is going to be, I would put this at the top of the list after, you know, the EPA and the Interior Department and the Energy Department, one of the key agencies that you'll see a lot of action out of this from the Biden administration.
Let's get to some more of your messages.
I've noticed as a master gardener that there are a lot of cities and states that use a huge amount of water in the United States for landscaping like turf in the middle of deserts. I'm wondering if the federal government could look at encouraging states and cities to use less water with monetary incentives to homeowners and commercial businesses to plant things that are more water efficient.
Amy, a very specific suggestion there, but is this in line with what we're seeing from the Biden administration so far?
Well, I think we haven't seen anything specific on this exact point yet, but I certainly anticipate this overall conversation to focus on water. I think droughts and lack of water is one of the clearest signs of climate change. And so particularly out west, in Colorado and California and Oregon and Washington, you're seeing droughts in a far more rampant way than you ever have before. And so inevitably there's going to be a reckoning, and you're already seeing that from the private sector. The private sector is actually, there's a new water exchange market in California to deal with this water scarcity. And so I think along with the Biden administration's overall agenda on climate adaptation, so adapting to a warmer world, I think water use is going to be high on that list.
You know, Christopher, when we talk about the private sector, we often focus on big companies when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. But what role do you think small businesses play here?
Well, small businesses really have a keystone position because there's so many of them, and they're much more nimble than these larger companies or tend to be. And they really want to innovate, and they really want to participate in helping this movement. And so I think they can really help think about new ideas of things that they've done to both save costs, which ultimately saves energy, but also how they think about the problem completely differently to a big business, because they're thinking about it from a grassroots level. They're kind of looking at it from the small scale. But if you amplify that across the millions of businesses and business owners, you actually will see a bigger effect than a single one company that's very large.
You know, Amy, during the Trump administration, we saw individual states step up with their own more aggressive climate plans. Talk about what we've seen emerge at the state and city level.
There has been a lot of action across the United States and across the world and across private companies. So in states in particular, you've seen New York and California and Washington State, and even, you know, some states more in the middle of the country, Minnesota, Senator Tina Smith's state has also made a lot of action, a lot of progress on this. You're seeing a lot of goals being put in place for, you know, basically a net zero economy going out to around 2050. And so that can be sort of hard for, you know, an average person to grapple with, because 30 years from now, and it's hard to think a week in advance. But nonetheless, these goals, although mostly symbolic, are nonetheless important to at least put a benchmark out there and a target. And so, but you're also seeing a lot of utilities, electric utilities, putting on similar 2050 goals, and oil companies are starting to do that now. And from what I understand, states are going to continue being really aggressive. I don't think they're going to pull back at all, even with the Biden administration in the White House. I think lastly, the important and I think controversial trend that I've seen at the state and city level is some efforts to ban natural gas as a heating source in new buildings, but also existing buildings. And I think there have been some cost concerns about whether or not that's the most cost-effective way to do it. And I think, you know, we can put that debate aside for a moment, but one thing is for sure, that trend will continue.
And how often at both the federal and the state level are we seeing climate plans intersect with concerns about environmental racism and equity?
You're seeing that a lot. I think New York in particular has been very vocal about ensuring that its actions are done in a way, like, for example, electric vehicle subsidies often go to wealthier people than to lower income communities, which often end up being communities of color. I think a parallel trend, and something I reported on last year, even before the pandemic, is that there is concern by some in the environmental justice area. I spoke with Reverend L. Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and also Mark Morial, the president of the National Urban League. They've expressed concern about moving too swiftly off of natural gas. And so that's because natural gas is a very cheap energy source. And I think over time, you're going to see this debate intensify. And the pandemic and, you know, the other evidence of systemic racism that we have in our society is really forcing this conversation to be, you know, infused into our climate change conversation. And I think that's a good thing, because if we don't consider communities of color and also people who work in the oil, natural gas, and coal industries, that if you don't consider these people's livelihoods, then there won't be a transition to cleaner energy at the level that scientists say we must.
Christopher, when it comes to decarbonization, that is eliminating carbon emissions, do you think President Biden is on track to meet the goals he set?
I think it's too early to tell. I think the thing that we come back to as modelers and also thinking about these problems is the total energy burden that people have, and to the point of you know, equitable transitions. If we think about the electricity sector, the goal that President Biden's put out there is zero emissions by 2035, and that sounds great at the face of it, and I think that's a great goal to have. But the issue with it is we need to electrify other sectors. Particularly things like heating and transportation. And what you want to do with that is you want to really have the cheapest electricity possible. And natural gas being part of that seems to be the most cheap way to do it, at least in the short term. And so we really need to think about the whole system rather than just electricity. And at the moment, it seems like the focus is a bit more on electricity than the other sectors because they don't seem to be linked. But we really need to be thinking about linking all those sectors and saying, hey, if someone's paying for gasoline and for natural gas for heating their homes, maybe they could pay for electricity to do that. And if we need to do that, they need to have new equipment. And if they need to do that as well, we need to have electricity be cheaper. And so banning these different technologies may in the face of it, make it harder and more expensive. And we need to really have the administration look at those different sectors together as one being, and actually focus on the whole sector's emissions rather than just one sector and saying we need to get that to zero, even though I know politically it's easier to just have one shiny goal.
Well, we got this email from Catherine who says, I would like for Biden to do everything possible to get the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act passed. This is not a tax. It is a fee, and the money coming from the fee would go to the low and middle income Americans every month. There is literally no time to worry about anything else. Amy, tell us more about this bill. We're getting a lot of questions about it.
Yeah, certainly. I've covered that bill quite a lot. And it's I think the interest among your viewers and others is a large testament to the Citizen Climate Lobby, which is a volunteer group that really whose mission is centered around this type of policy. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, this, you know, some people call it a fee, others call it a tax. I think technically it's a tax, but that the money would go to certain sectors of the population. I think there's a couple of problems, you know, challenges that this policy faces. The first is the one I mentioned earlier, that, you know, in the depths of a recession, it's going to be very difficult for these senators and House members to support any type of new fee that goes to the American people ultimately. So there's that overarching challenge. And then the second one is, you know, when Congress ever, you know, issues a new tax and you have all this money suddenly coming into the federal coffers, you know, there's so much demand on that money. And so I wrote a column recently for Axios, and it was like, you know, something about so much money and so many problems to go along with it. So do you put the money toward lower income people? Do you put the money toward energy and innovation? Do you put the money toward the oil and gas and coal companies who are struggling? And I think this bill in particular talks about sending the money back to the American people, which sounds nice in theory, but politically it could run into a lot of headwinds. That all said, not to be sort of a negative Nancy, I'm just sort of calling it like it is, I do think ultimately this type of policy will prevail sometime in the next several years, because it, you know, putting an environmental cost on these fossil fuels is at least one critical part of the entire agenda.
We're talking about what a Biden administration means for the fight against climate change with Amy Harder of Axios and Christopher Clack, founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy. You've argued, Amy, that political division could actually be a positive thing for creating lasting climate policy. Why?
Well, because, you know, as we're seeing with President Biden, and we saw with Trump and Obama, you know, the last couple of decades has been what I call a swinging pendulum of regulatory policy. So let's, you know, going back just to the George W. Bush administration, who really didn't do much on environmental issues. So then Obama comes in, issues a bunch of regulations, and then Trump comes in and repeals all those regulations. And then Biden is here and he's going to reinstate all of these regulations. Meanwhile, the business community is, you know, grappling with all this uncertainty, and emissions, heat trapping emissions continue to go up. And so there's this ongoing debate, you know, in our country and in Washington about, you know, should we try to enact the policy that the scientists say will be sufficient to address climate change, or should we do whatever is politically possible now and that will actually last? And so, you know, I think given the tightly divided Congress, bipartisanship will be inevitable. And I think there will be support for increasing a lot of innovation funding. And a lot of experts I talk to say that one path to addressing climate change is for America to really, you know, push down the gas pedal, no pun intended, on innovating on these new technologies, the ones that Christopher was talking about, beyond just the electricity sector, and making those technologies cheaper and more widely deployed. So then countries like India, which is rapidly growing and is probably not going to do a carbon price anytime soon because, you know, that could hurt its growth, that it could adopt these technologies that have become cheaper. And so that's really critical, because ultimately this is a global problem, and what happens in the United States really matters most to the degree that it helps reduce global emissions.
We got this tweet from Andrew, who says, I feel that much of the dialogue surrounding fighting climate change focuses too much on its ability to create economic growth and jobs. Even the most progressive policies like the Green New Deal focuses on economic growth. Christopher, what do you make of that critique?
I think it's a fair critique of the sort of the public face of these sort of pushes forward pathways and deals. I think the reason for that is to kind of highlight the fact that we've had a lot of history where we've said that if we wanted to deal with climate change, it might hurt the economy, might drag on it, we might lose jobs. And I think people have just responded to that by highlighting those things. I think the key is with all those things, all of them do the same thing, right? They all reach zero emissions or near zero emissions, which means we're dealing with climate change. But we're showing through those sort of reports and the way they public face them is that there's benefits to this that aren't just about the energy. There's more jobs, there's huge investments. And that's what they're really trying to do. They're trying to say, hey, actually, we can do both. We can deal with the climate change and we can also reduce costs for customers and employ more jobs. And really, it's about getting down to the nub of it, which is all this is going to take huge amounts of investment through renewables, transmission, DERs, and novel technologies. And we need to do this in a way that grows the economy. And the reason we need to grow the economy is because it becomes a blueprint for others to do the same thing. If we do this and we slow down the economy and we make it really hard and expensive and we make social injustice worse, people are not going to want to replicate that around the world. And what we really need to be able to do is show this as a blueprint and say, hey, we can do this and we'll do this in a way that actually benefits our economy, not just hurts it.
Amy, very, very briefly, Biden is expected to sign several more executive orders to address climate change this week. What else is coming down the pipe?
I think we're going to see a lot of action on, prioritizing clean energy over oil and natural gas. You saw the Interior Department last week froze new leases for oil and natural gas, which is significant. Freeze new leases on federal lands. And so I anticipate you'll see more action like that.
That's Amy Harder. She's an energy and climate reporter for Axios. Also with us was Christopher Clack. He's the founder and CEO of Vibrant Clean Energy, a company that builds software and consults clients on clean energy solutions. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.